also the seminary president. He's taught at other universities and institutions, Gordon Conwell, Stanford University, and Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. He's also written a number of books. One that I have appreciated over the years is An Unexpected Journey, Discovering Reformed Christianity, where he charts his own experience coming into a Reformed church. So would you please give a warm welcome to Dr. Robert Godfrey.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here. And when Angelo first invited me, I offered him a couple of different topics that I could speak on. So if this one doesn't turn out that well, you can blame Angelo. It's always good to have a scapegoat. And I also am glad that Angelo announced that there would be lunch coming. So, you know, there's always something to look forward to. That's good when you're at a conference. And during question and answer time, if I get stuck on a Hebrew question, I'll call on Angelo or Mark or William or Robert. We just have a lot of John, a lot of Hebrew experts here. So we should be in good shape. I actually sort of stumbled on Samson. I went to see an opera by Saint-Saëns on Samson and Delilah. And in watching it, I thought, there are a lot of parts to this opera that aren't actually in the Bible, it seems to me. And then I realized that although I knew some things about Samson, I had never really given careful thought to his story as it's told in the book of Judges. And as I went back to look at it, several things struck me. One was, it's kind of a deplorable story. I read Judges 16. Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her. What kind of a story is that for the Bible? I actually thought if I had little kids at home and I was reading the Bible for devotions, you might give the second half of the book of Judges a pass. It's full of all sorts of deplorable things, terrible things, shocking things. What are we to make of this? Why is this book in the Bible? Why are these stories in the Bible? What is God trying to teach us? And so it began a journey for me to study this story and to discover it's a much more interesting, a much more complicated story than we usually recognize. It is not just sort of jammed into the Bible as an afterthought. It's very carefully composed and told to make a point, make several points. That's what we're going to try to look at. And not only to understand Samson himself, but to try to see Samson as something of a mirror of the church today. Now, what's the function of a mirror? The function of a mirror is to help us see what we look like. That's why some of us like mirrors better than others. My mother-in-law always says that she loves the mirror first thing in the morning when she looks into the mirror and thinks she looks pretty good, and then she puts on her glasses and is appalled. So mirrors are intended to help us see ourselves as we are. And Paul says in Romans 15, doesn't he, verse 4, that all of Scripture is given to us by God to warn us, to encourage us, to lead us to endure in the faith. All of the Scripture has a function to help us, and the helping is, in a sense, to hold up a mirror so we can say, do I look like that? Does the church today look like that? Are there parts or aspects of the life of the church today that look like that? John Milton, the great English poet, wrote an epic poem on Samson. And in that poem, he said, Samson is a mirror of our fickle state. So I stole the idea of mirror from Milton, but he's a good one to steal from. But a mirror of our fickle state, that's interesting, of our changeable, unreliable, uncertain state. And I think it's worth us pausing and thinking about that as we go along. That Samson does indeed have lessons to teach us. But to understand those lessons, we have to see him in the context in which he's presented in the book of Judges. And to understand that, we have to ask, why is the book of Judges in the Bible at all? In a sense, that's a question that Bible believers are sometimes slow to ask because it doesn't seem like a pious question. We have the Bible God gave us, so we study the Bible God gave us, and we try to take it and learn from it. And that's a good thing. But God had a plan with each of the books he put in the Bible. And so it's right that we should ask, why is it in the Bible? What's he teaching us in the Bible? And the big message of the book of Judges is that when you lose great leaders like Moses and Joshua and have not yet come to a great leader like David, life can go to rack and ruin pretty quickly. The book of Judges, you know, ends with that very famous verse. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That, in a sense, is the whole purpose of the book of Judges. To show Israel and to show us that the people of God need a king. And that after Moses and Joshua, who had functioned in a king-like way over the people, die, the people begin almost inexorably to move away from God, away from faithful service of God, away from true care about God. And God, in his mercy, begins to raise up judges, also called deliverers, saviors, to help the people in their need. But the book of Judges shows us that those judges could never really do the job that was needed. And indeed, that as time went on, the judges themselves began to be more and more corrupt, to be more and more marred themselves by the sins of the people that they were supposed to help. And so early in the book, Othniel, Ehud, Deborah are judges with great faithfulness who serve the Lord. But then things begin to go downhill. And Gideon does some good work, but he's a man filled with fears in his service of the Lord. And then we have Jephthah, who is reckless in his service of the Lord. And then we come to the last judge. As I count them, the 12th judge in the book of Judges, Samson. And his is the longest story in the book, the longest story of a judge in the book. Seems to me the most intricately prepared of all the judges' stories in the book. And after Judges, after Samson, the book of Judges just descends into moral chaos and degeneracy. Probably the worst described anywhere in the Bible. And all of that is saying, you people need a king. You can't do it on your own. You can't even do it with the local judges that God has raised up to try to deliver you. And we see at the beginning of the Samson story in Judges 13 how desperate the situation is. Israel has been oppressed for 40 years. They're back in the wilderness. It's like they're not even in the land of promise. That's how desperate the situation is. That's how much they need a deliverer. And yet, the story says that Israel has sort of lost hope. The angel of the Lord comes to Samson's mother, a woman we're never told her name, and she's barren. She's had no children. But we're not told that she's prayed for a child. We're not told that she's hoping for a child. She sort of represents Israel that has given up, that is hopeless, that has not even enough strength or faith to turn to the Lord and plead for deliverance and help. They're just sort of fatalistic in the situation in which they find themselves. And so the grace of God is a surprise. The grace of mercy and remembrance of God comes as a wonderful thing to them, something unexpected. And I think of those words in Psalm 113. The Lord is high above all nations and His glory above the heavens. Who is like the Lord our God, who is seated on high and who looks far down on the heavens and the earth? God is so glorious, Psalm 113 says, that God has to look down to see heaven. That's how exalted He is. That's how glorious He is. But in all of His glory, He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes, with the princes of His people. And that's what the story of Samson is very much about. A God who has not forgotten His people, and so comes to them in their need, really surprises them to raise up a deliverer. And part of what's really fascinating about the story of Samson is that the story revolves around four women. Women tend to be a problem in Samson's life. But the story revolves around the women in his life. His mother, his Philistine wife, the Gaza prostitute, and then Delilah. And it's interesting that of these four women, only Delilah has a name that's given us in the account. But almost 25% of the story of Samson is before he's born, is the preparation for his coming. And we know throughout the Bible, whenever the Bible gives a lot of description to the preparation of one who's about to be born, that person is of great importance in redemptive history. And that's the way it is with Samson. And so the angel of the Lord comes to the mother of Samson and he looks fairly ordinary, because she doesn't recognize him as the angel of the Lord. She thinks maybe he's a prophet. And he tells her that she's going to have a child. And then it's fascinating to pause and ask, what exactly is said about that child? What kind of a child is this child supposed to be? And probably a lot of us would expect, if we have just a kind of vague memory of the Samson story, a lot of us might well expect that the first thing the angel would say is, we're going to make him a deliverer of his people and he'll be strong. But there's not a word from the angel about the strength of Samson. The angel is not coming to talk about the strength that Samson will have. He never makes a reference to it. What does he talk about to the mother of Samson that this child should be, that she and her husband should take responsibility to ensure he will be? He says this child is to be separated to the Lord. That's the key thing that the angel of the Lord wanted to see in Samson. Someone separated to the Lord. And of course, this particular revelation makes so much sense, because what was the great problem that Israel was having? Israel was failing to be a people separated to the Lord. Israel had been given a land of promise by itself. It had been given laws to govern and separate itself. almost all the laws that we see in Israel are laws of separation. You're not to eat like the people. You're not to dress like the nations. You're not to worship like the nations. You're not to intermarry with the nations. You are to be a separated people. And what exactly was the problem that Israel was falling into? They were failing to be separate. They were becoming like the nations. And of course, the great complaint of the Lord is that they were regularly coming to worship like the nations, worship the gods of the nations. They were being led astray by intermarriage with the nations. And so the angel of the Lord comes to this mother and he says, you need to raise a child that will be separate. Not just separated as the whole nation should have been separated, but this child will be specially separated under the Nazarite vow. Now, you may remember the Nazarite vow was described in Numbers chapter 6. It was a special vow of separation, not binding on all the people, but to indicate a special dedication and consecration to the service of the Lord. And one of the features of a Nazarite was that he would not cut his hair. So that's where that part of the Samson story comes from. Samson is not to be just ordinarily separated. He's to be especially separated unto the Lord. And not cutting his hair is to be a sign of that separation. Now, Nazarite, as all of you Hebrew scholars know, is simply the Hebrew word for separation. And so the Nazarite vow is really just the separation vow. And so the angel of the Lord comes to the mother and says, your son will be a judge in Israel, and he will be separated to the Lord, consecrated to the Lord's service, and the sign of that will be particularly that he does not cut his hair. Now, why not cut his hair? Well, in part because that is a visible sign of separation. People will be able to see that you're different. Apparently, most people did cut their hair. We don't know exactly how short they cut it. But it must have been a pain in the ancient world to have really long hair. We don't know how often they bathed. Cleanliness was not a high priority in the ancient world. The Romans were very clean. That's why they built baths wherever they went. But the Romans were regarded as peculiar on that point. In any case, having long hair would be a further hygienic burden. But it would be visible. You'd stand out in a crowd as a man with long, long hair that had never been cut your whole life. And so the mother is pressed with this point to be separate. And then comes what I think of as one of the most fascinating parts of this story, this call to separation. Samson's parents seem to be somewhat pious Israelites, and the mother goes immediately to her husband, Manoah, and says to him what the experience has been with the angel of the Lord. And Manoah then apparently very piously prays to the Lord and says, O Lord, send again your angel, or your spokesman at any rate. It's not clear they are yet aware this is an angel. Send again your spokesman, that he may tell us more about how we are to raise this child separated unto the Lord. Now that sounds really pious, doesn't it? They're not only accepting what the angel of the Lord has called them to do and to be in relation to this child, but now they're asking for more help in raising this child properly. And the response of the angel, the Lord in mercy sends the angel again. And the response is really interesting if you read it carefully. The angel of the Lord simply repeats the instructions he had given the first time. Manoah had asked for more help, more instruction, more information. And the angel comes and doesn't give him any more. He just repeats what he'd said. Now, why does that happen? It's always good to pause when you're reading a Bible story and ask, why does that happen? Why are we told that? Why are we told that in that way? What's the point of all this? If the Lord wasn't going to give any more instruction, why did he send the angel again? And if he did send the angel again, why didn't the angel give any more instruction? Well, I think the Lord is teaching a very important lesson to these parents and to the church in every age. Because what the angel of the Lord is really saying is, your problem as parents is not a lack of information. Your problem as parents is whether you're going to follow the directions I've given you or not. The problem of the people of God in every age is that not that they don't know enough about the will of the Lord. The issue in every generation is, are we going to follow the will of the Lord? And when we appear to be pious and say, oh, Lord, we'd do more if we knew more, we're really being critical of the Lord. The Lord has failed to give us the information we need. Now, when I was a student at seminary, one of the most helpful things said to me is the Bible is a big book. And that's true, isn't it? The Bible is a big book. It really has a lot of information. Before we go to the Lord and say we need more information, we maybe ought to ask ourselves, how well have we mastered the information given us? But you see how important it is from the Lord's point of view that we focus on what he has given us in his word and not implicitly complain that he hasn't given us enough. I'm always fascinated by churches that seem to be able to give people a lot more information about the will of the Lord than the Bible has. And people are really drawn to that. How to raise your children. That's a great theme in some churches. And you can get all sorts of advice that doesn't really come out of the Bible. And sometimes as parents, we face situations with children and we think, I wish I knew what to do about this. And the Lord is sort of saying to us, well, you know, what you really need to know is teach the Lord, teach your children my word. Teach them what's in the word. Don't worry about all the things that you'd like to know that you don't know. Teach them what you do know. Or churches have lots of conferences on marriage. How to have a good marriage, how to have a strong marriage, how to have a happy marriage. That's a great theme. The truth is, the Bible doesn't say that much about marriage. It says, love one another. Don't be angry with one another. Be faithful to one another. Actually, if you could master those three things, you'd be doing pretty well. The problem with most marriages is they haven't mastered those three things. And this is what the angel of the Lord, I think, is saying to the mother of Samson. Don't ask for more information about separation. Master what you've been told about separation. For example, don't marry the daughters of the nations. What's the very first thing that will happen to Samson as an adult, as the story is told? He will see a Philistine woman and want to marry her. Was there a lack of information there? No, in fact, the Lord was remarkably clear about that. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Don't intermarry with the nations because they will be a snare to you and lead you away from the Lord your God. This has been one of the great themes of the Bible through its whole history. It's a theme in the New Testament, isn't it? Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. It's a pretty clear message. And yet, it's a message that ultimately was not carried out. When Samson sees the Philistine woman that he wants to be his wife, his father does say to him, "Can you not find a wife amongst your own people? Must you marry a woman amongst the uncircumcised Philistines? Must you marry a woman who's not in covenant with the Lord our God?" His father knew the law. His father applied the law correctly. But when Samson said, "I want her," the father went off to negotiate the contract. And here we have a kind of mirror to us today, don't we? How's it going with the church and the church's calling to be separate, to be separated from the nations? Over and over again in the New Testament, we are described as an exiled people. And we're an exiled people because our home, our true citizenship, is in heaven. And so we're waiting. We're waiting as exiles for the day in which the glory of heaven will come to earth in the new heaven and the new earth. Or we're waiting for the day of glory when we're taken from this earth to heaven. And 1 Peter in his letter over and over again says, so as you're waiting as an exile, be separate. Be different from the world. Be different from the world in the way in which you live. So that the world will see that you are a separated people. That's what God's people have always been called to. And that's the call that God's people have always found to be the most difficult. Because the world is ever with us, as the hymn goes, around us and within. And so it is so easy for the values of the world, the standards of the world, the attractions of the world to become our values and our attractions. And the Lord has called us to be a separated people. And the story of Samson holds up this mirror that says, so how's that separation going? How much does the world see us as different? And I think it's a huge problem. Now, when I say the church, I'm not talking just about Reformed churches. I'm talking about the church in America generally. We could talk about the worldwide church, but we have enough problems in America. We don't have to try to solve everybody else's problems. How's the church in America doing? Well, not so well. The liberal church seems indistinguishable from the Democratic Party. And the conservative church often seems indistinguishable from the Republican Party. And as far as I can see, neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party is particularly interested in Christ or his kingdom. How separate are we? How separate should we be? What are the standards that should be informing the life of the church? Obviously, the scripture is not telling us all to stop cutting our hair. That's not the kind of separation we're called to today. We're called to a spiritual separation. We're called to a separation of holiness. And we have to ask, how's that going? And I think the sad truth must be that the church generally, and that includes some of us conservative Reformed people, have become rather comfortable in the world. Maybe it's just because I'm getting old that I'm beginning to get reflective on some of these things. I think back to the 1920s when the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church declared that Christians ought not to play cards, dance, or go to movies. And they did that to oppose what were then called worldly amusements. In the 1980s, I was a delegate to a Christian Reformed Synod where we were told that that prohibition against dancing no longer was in effect because we had redeemed the dance. I was delighted to hear that. But I was a little skeptical. I suspected the case could be made that dancing in the 1980s was more problematic than dancing in the 1920s. Today, almost every Christian college has a film arts major. And so instead of seeing movies as worldly amusements, we now seem to see them as a major that we can study and an industry in which we can involve ourselves. And I think if you compare movies in the 1920s to movies in the early 21st century, we'll see that movies have really been transformed. They have gone from bad to much worse. Now, my point is not to attack movies or to resurrect the idea of an easy list to check off in terms of separation. But I think it does illustrate for us, how is that separation ideal going? Now, it was easier in the 20s. I bet in the 20s, Ripon had no dance hall. So it wasn't all that much a temptation to go dancing. I bet in the 1920s, Ripon had no movie theater. So movies weren't all that much a temptation. And we can look back at our forebears and say sometimes there was too much legalism in the way they approached the subject of Christian living. But they were at least raising the question, how are we to be separate? How are we to be different? How are we to live a life that is not accommodated to the standards and values of this world? But how are we to be different in the service to the Lord? And again, it's very easy to try to come up with a checklist of these things. And it's much harder to do what Peter calls the church to do in 1 Peter, namely to be loving, to be marked by love and mutual concern and care for one another. One of the things I've been doing, reading lately, is to read a little bit about the late Roman Empire, because it was a time of transition from a pagan world to a world in which Christian values, at least on the surface, came to dominate. I thought it was kind of intriguing. How does it happen that a whole culture moves from being a largely pagan culture to, at least on the surface, being a largely Christian culture? And one of the key factors in that change was that pagans were confronted with the unavoidable reality that Christian love stood out against pagan selfishness. And that came to be manifested in several ways in particular. Pagans who had a child that they didn't want to raise because it was perhaps defective or the wrong gender or just not wanted, they could just take outside the city and leave on a hillside. And most of those children would die from exposure. And Christians began to go out and take those children and raise those children. And pagans eventually had to say, this is a community that really loves. It's amazing. Self-sacrificingly. And then this was a period in which plagues would hit cities because the hygiene was so bad. And the pagan attitude was, if you're in an area where the plague hits, run away, get away from it. If you have to leave family and friends behind, that's all right, just run away from it. And Christians would stay and care for plague victims, often at great risk to themselves, often sacrificing their own lives. Christians began to lobby for better treatment for slaves. In the Roman Empire, perhaps as much as 15% of the empire were slaves, and a slave had no rights over his or her own body. Anything could be done to them sexually, and they had no complaints, no right of appeal. And Christians eventually saw to the changing of those laws to protect some of the rights, at least, of slaves. And so that difference that Christians manifested, that love that Christians manifested, that separation from the values of the world that Christians manifested made a huge difference. And now that we're back in a period of history that many observers are beginning to call post-Christian, we have to ask ourselves even more pointedly, how should we be separate? How should we be different? How do we avoid the kinds of problems we see in Samson, and we'll see more in Samson, as he refuses to be separated to the Lord as he was called to be? As he comes to just rejoice in the strength that the Spirit of the Lord has given him. Because he is strong. Because he does remarkable things with his strength. He'll kill a lion with his bare hands. He'll kill 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of an ass. He'll pull down a temple with his arms. He'll carry off the gates of a city for miles. The Lord gives him the most amazing strength. But most of the time, he's not clearly using it in the service of the Lord. And that becomes a pressing question for the church in America. The church in America today has remarkable strength. Most European Christians who visit America are amazed at the size of the churches, at the numbers of people attending, at the budgets of churches, at the amount of money being raised to support Christian causes. There is remarkable strength in the American church in many ways. But I remember vividly being in England a few years ago and being taken to a city that had been something of a resort city in the latter part of the 19th century, and on almost every corner had been built a church, because this was the day of British evangelical Victorian piety, vitality, and life, and every group wanted to have its own church building to point to its strength and its success and its commitment and its presence. And when I was taken there, it's probably about 10 years ago, I guess. Almost every one of those churches was closed. Some of them had been torn down. Some of them had been turned into office buildings or into schools. Almost none of them were churches. In a century, what had seemed the remarkable strength and vitality and commitment of the English to Christianity had all but evaporated. And I think we as Christians have to pause today in America and say, is the strength of the church, the apparent strength of the church, really evidence of strength today? Or are we sort of coasting on a legacy that we inherited and to which we are not really making a contribution of separation unto the Lord. That's the great problem, I think, we have to face today. The great issue we have to face today. Of course, that is the danger of old people, to begin to say, well, you know, in the good old days, and the good old days were almost never as good as old people remember them as being. But nevertheless, we have to ask, are we losing things that we shouldn't be losing? For many of us, there was a conviction that the Sabbath day was a key measure and example of our separation. There were things we didn't do on the Sabbath day that other people did. We spent our time in the Sabbath day in ways different from the ways in which the world spent the Sabbath day. Maybe I've told you this before, but it always fascinates me as a historian that when the National Football League began to play games on Sunday in the 1950s, they were told that they would never succeed because Americans wouldn't watch football on Sunday. The commitment of American Christianity broadly in the 1950s was still so oriented to church and to Sunday as a Sabbath unto the Lord that secularists said to the football planners, don't play on Sunday, you won't get an audience. Well, I hardly need to ask who's won that battle. Churches now so accommodate that we've all heard the stories of churches holding services on Super Bowl Sunday at halftime and serving popcorn to get somebody to come. So how's that going for the church? The church has reacted in many places by saying, well, let's make Christianity easier. Let's make Christianity simpler. Let's make Christianity less demanding. And I think the world has learned the lesson that we've too frequently been teaching, that if you make it simpler and less demanding, what you're really saying is it's not as important as we once claimed. And then people have said, well, if it's not that important, then why be involved? It seems to me the crying need of the hour is that we as God's people would be renewed in a sense of the call upon our lives that we would be separate, that we would be different. Not different by a whole list of human do's and don'ts. One of the tragedies of the whole Christian ideal in the late ancient period was Christians soon decided that the best way to ensure sexual morality was for everybody to become a monk or a nun and not marry. That would ensure purity. That would ensure discipline. That would ensure keeping the law of God. Well, in the first place, it didn't succeed at doing that. But it also raised a whole standard of holiness that was not biblical at all. And we always have to be careful about that as the church, that we don't begin to ask people to do things that God hasn't asked them to do. But we do need to be coming back to ask, what does God want us to be? What does God want us to do? How does God want us to be separate and different? And how can we pursue that best? How can we accomplish that best? You know, I think when you study the history of the church, what you see is that there are great uptimes and great downtimes. And that, to a significant extent, is in the hands of the Lord. It's His providence. It's the mystery of His care and work and service for the church. When Joshua was at the end of his life, he gathered the people of Israel together and he proclaimed again the covenant and the law of God and what God asked of his people. And the people all said, "This we will do." And Joshua responded by saying, "You're not able to do it." And I think what Joshua really meant there, we know Joshua was a Calvinist, but I don't think primarily he was being a Calvinist there. I think what he really meant there is, I'll be gone and you won't have a leader to remind you of what you ought to do. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. When Joshua was gone, within a few years, they began to forget. They began to drift. They began to slide. And God would raise up judges, but it wasn't really until God came with his King David that there was a significant renewal. We see that in the history of the church, too. We see that in the history of the Reformed churches. Times of great blessing, times of great success, then times of growing weakness and failure and futility, it seems. And we can't control those things. We can't control the big picture. But we can control ourselves, in a sense. And what does Hebrews say after talking about Samson and others? It says what we need to do is look to Jesus, the beginner and the completer of our faith. And to run the race that he sets before us, laying aside as much of the sin as we can that weighs us down in that race, but running as Jesus did for the joy set before him, so that we will complete the race and that we will be found faithful, and so that we too will be in that list of those who live by faith. It's intriguing who's on that list, especially the summary that we have near the end of Hebrews 11. Jephthah's on the list. Gideon's on the list. Samson's on the list. Deborah's not on the list. Why is that? Male chauvinism? She didn't live by faith? No, neither of those things. He puts on the list not the strongest, but the weakest to encourage us. Gideon the fearful. Jephthah the reckless. Samson, the selfish. They still had within them a root of faith out of which they served the Lord in all of their weakness, in all their foolishness, in all of their sinfulness. And Hebrews is saying, in your weakness, don't give up. Don't lose heart. Look to Jesus, who for the joy set before him ran the race and promises you grace to run the race, strength to live by faith. And so when we hold up a mirror to the church, a mirror of Samson, who is not separated the way he ought to be, did not use his strength the way he ought to have, we mustn't allow that mirror to drive us to despair, but we ought to let that mirror remind us that God's in control, that God will accomplish his purpose, and that what he calls us to do is to look to Jesus, to trust in him, and to be faithful with the strength and the separation to which we're called. Thank you for your kind attention to that point. We'll go on and look at more of the Samson story. We haven't even really got him born yet, but we will in the next lecture, and begin to look at how Samson lived and how that's a mirror for us. Thank you very much.